you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, artificial intelligence, AI. To translate voices or access your bank account, to select targets to bomb and someone to kill, along with thousands of others.
It's the same kind of technology that unlocks my cell phone, the facial recognition software that I use. I find that really handy. If I need to make a bank transfer, I use it to unlock my phone. But this is also the same kind of thing that can be integrated into a surveillance drone. That surveillance drone uses that facial recognition software to select and execute targets on battlefields.
In occupied Palestine, Israeli soldiers target everyone, everywhere, in children's theaters, no less.
They target everything related with the life. They target the Freedom Theater, they target the youth center, they target the road, the streets, they destroy it. They target the trees, they target the cars, they destroy everything. What's happened with the Freedom Theater? They bombed the doors of the stage. They change it to be like Arrested Center.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before dropping a few AI bombs, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Days have passed since the deadly events of October 7th. Israel's retaliatory assault, Operation Iron Swords, has been way deadlier. 80 days into its bombing campaign, hearkening memories of Dresden, Cologne, and Hamburg, the Jewish state has dropped an estimated 25,000 tons of ordnance on the tiny enclave, among the most densely populated in the world, already crippled by 18 years of Israeli siege. Among Israel's 22,000 targets, hundreds of residential buildings, power targets, the Israelis call these, huge casualty numbers, over 20,000 dead, half of them children and infants. Countless more are buried under the rubble. 53,000 Gazans have been injured and 1.9 million displaced, now cold, starving, and many of them ill. Sound brutal? You bet. Also, very intelligent. Israel has an artificially intelligent targeting system. The Gospel, it's called. Pioneers in mass surveillance, Israeli intelligence units have oceans of terabytes to feed it. Countless hours of drone and satellite footage, intercepted communications, personal data up the yin-yang. Gospel spits out targets like there's no tomorrow, from 50 a year to 100 a day. It even calculates collateral damage. Nothing happens by accident, an IDF source told Israeli journalists. When a three-year-old girl is killed, it's because someone decided it wasn't a big deal, a price worth paying in order to hit someone else. To learn more about AI-based warfighting systems like Israel's Orwellianly named Gospel and their sinister connection to social media and domestic policing, the GPM traveled to Utrecht, here in the Netherlands, home base for the Realities of Algorithmic Warfare project. Jessica Dorsey and Lauren Gould are project leaders. Dennis Janssen is a PhD candidate in the Department of Media and Culture Studies. The first voice you'll hear, Lauren Gould. Jessica and Dennis follow.
The Realities of Algorithmic Warfare project came from this insight that the automation or making certain weapon systems increasingly autonomous through algorithms and machine learning reinforces certain patterns, and we want to, as a program, investigate not only how these systems are innovated through the military and the machines they work with, but also look at how they're deployed, in what theatres of war, and really importantly, what impact they have, like again, on civilian harm, but also on democratic control. A lot of people reflect on the human-machine interaction, so the interaction between militaries and these technologies, but very few traced, like the kill chain all the way down to actually the theatres of war in which they're being implemented, which we now see, of course, the Israeli military are using AI weapon systems in Gaza and the detrimental effect that has on civilians.
What is this system again? What's the name of this system, that the AI system the Israelis are developing, that's aimed at cooking up targets?
They refer to it as the gospel. Mm-hmm. So we could do a whole discourse analysis of how these particular projects are named. This is a system that through reporting we found out that it essentially wades through a mass amount of data that's been collected by the Israelis over the years on Palestinians in order to generate lists of targets, people against whom lethal force can be used, deployed. Before this system was integrated into their war fighting, they came up with approximately 50 targets per year. And what this AI system purportedly does is come up with something like hundreds of targets per day. And they do claim to make decisions. The humans are still making the decision to fire the weapon. However, the scale and the speed at which this AI generates targeting lists and that the Israelis act upon it, this is the real game changer that we're seeing. The scale and the speed is something we've never seen before in warfare. We term this automation bias, and that is something where it's essentially the computer has generated this. I don't have enough time to really look through it. I will just defer to the computer's calculations or the algorithm's suggestion. And civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of these decisions.
So we have in place a lot of surveillance systems. Now, these surveillance systems could entail drone footage, also can entail satellite imagery, metadata from telephones, online search behavior of individuals. And what happens is through these algorithms, what they do is try to predict human behavior and sentiment and say, okay, based on all this data, this person is a legitimate target. The computer says, yes. There is often still a human in the loop saying, okay, the computer says yes, therefore we'll push the button to trigger an attack. However, the speed at which these targets are presented and the speed at which the human is reacting really illustrates that there is very little human meaningful control over looking into what data was used and what was being predicted in a very careful, systematic way. So that's the role of the algorithm. Once a building is targeted, nobody of the military goes to that building and starts identifying, okay, you're obviously a Hamas leader, you were a civilian, you were a civilian, no, 10 other civilians. Now we've sacrificed 300 civilians for one Hamas leader. That's, you know, not in any way in line with the rules of law or rules of engagement. Therefore, we need to, you know, adapt this algorithm and this machine learning system so it does better next time. That actually doesn't happen in war. So in its design, it's already very questionable whether this would ever be able to target the right people because it doesn't have that feedback loop.
Promoters of these technologies, I think many of them say that AI and machine learning will make target selection and actual targeting much more discriminated and specific and less violent. Barack Obama came to be known as the bomber in chief. And I mean, nobody had ever used drones as often as Barack Obama did in his strikes in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere.
Well, I think you've pinpointed a beautiful example. Obama also admitted that the machinery of the unmanned drone, there's a wonderful quote that it made people feel like it wasn't war anymore. And this comes to your idea of the ludification of war.
What do we mean by that term, ludification or ludification of war?
How do you pronounce it? It's Dennis's term.
I see that term and I think it's a Luddite. Luddites don't like technology.
But ludifiers really, really do like technology very much. Yes, it's ludification because it comes from making something ludic, so making it more playful. Very often when I'm talking to people about this, they'll say, oh, you mean the gamification of warfare? Which is, okay, that's a fine term, but I try to sort of broaden it up a little bit, because usually when people talk about gamification, it becomes very much about, well, indeed, this idea of drone warfare no longer being war anymore. Indeed, it's more like you're either watching or playing a video game, you know, from a distance detached, just pushing a button and the kill happens thousands of miles away from you. And, of course, the interfaces that you operate these kinds of technologies with, looking or feeling very video game console-like. So, for instance, a lot of loitering munitions or kamikaze drones, as they're sometimes called. So basically just a guided bomb with a camera on it that an infantry soldier can just launch on their own are often controlled with what basically looks like a Nintendo Switch. They've just got a little screen and they've got joysticks on the end of it, on both ends of it. So that's part of it. But it becomes a little bit broader than that. Also, for instance, in the way that these technologies are, as we've mentioned, sort of innovated with or experimented with, that itself also tends to have this sort of playful element in it where, as I like to say, failure becomes a productive force, so to say. So you're taking these out into a field exercise, or you're just taking them out onto the streets of your military base, and you're controlling it with your little gamepad and you're trying out maneuvers and trying to see, for instance, what that does to the sort of cognitive load of a soldier operating this. Is he able to control the vehicle and also still keep up with the people around him? This, too, has to me a sort of a playful element to it, where the same risk also looms where, oh, we're just experimenting with this. We're just trying out what it can do. It's not really part of war. But in the meantime, of course, this is being funded by taxpayer money, and the actual application of these things is still very much a war-fighting activity. Mm-hmm. And the risk of this sort of experimental attitude also risks kind of like losing that connection to the seriousness of war, I would say. Generally speaking, the big drone platforms are still being developed by very traditional defense companies. So, you know, the MQ-9 Reaper is one by General Atomics, and loitering munitions are getting developed by Air Environment. And tech companies tend to be more involved, if you can make a hard distinction already between classic defense companies and tech companies, because they are themselves already becoming more and more militarized. For example, the American Department of Defense gets more interested in collaborating with companies like Google and Amazon and these kinds of places. But they tend to be more involved with the development and innovation of modular technologies, software. So Project Maven is a really great example of this, where Google's image processing platform was being used by the Department of Defense to process their image data that they gather with their global surveillance systems and drones and all these kinds of things.
So there's a synergy between the civilian uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Very much so, yeah. It's actually a very difficult problem that this sort of what we call dual use aspect of AI is so pervasive. Very often, what you see is that things that get developed in the civilian sphere are very close to being applicable already in the military sphere. Project Maven is a great example of this, I think.
All these surveillance technologies, so the data that's being used to now feed into war practices is the same data that we produce ourselves as citizens, right? It's the data, mm-hmm. our search behavior on Google or our social media posts, our, you know, telephone conversations. The militaries involved and their partners, the big tech companies involved in developing these technologies, are also developing them and testing them on us. So, for example, the Dutch military was so eager to develop AI possibilities and to develop these capabilities to sift through large amounts of data and make them actionable based on algorithms. What they did is, during COVID, set up a team that tracked the sentiment and behavior of Dutch citizens in name of the crisis, the COVID crisis, to predict where there might be civil unrest. And then they sold these predictions to the police. And these civil unrests were anti-COVID protests, but also Black Lives Matter protests and protests against 5G, for example. Now, this was against all privacy regulation. The military is not allowed to collect data on citizens within its own borders. So they did so, you know, out of the public eye and against all privacy regulation. Now, this ultimately, the wonderful work of investigative journalists brought this to the public eye and political debate. There was a huge uproar in Parliament, and ultimately this centre was stopped, and research was done and said this was illegal, this was not allowed. Now, it was really interesting to see what the military's response to this was, saying we need to change the laws.
It's the same kind of technology, just to give some concrete examples, that unlocks my cell phone, the facial recognition software that I use. I find that really handy. If I need to make a bank transfer, I use it to unlock my phone. But this is also the same kind of thing that can be integrated into a surveillance drone, and then that same surveillance drone gathers the data, processes it, and then uses that facial recognition software to select and execute targets on battlefields. Yeah. So to understand that those kinds of examples, the same goes for a large language model. So the ChatGPT that many of us are experimenting with or using to maybe draft some emails, or college students are using it to perhaps help them in their essay writing. That kind of stuff, when integrated by, for example, Palantir, in their AI platform.
What's Palantir?
Palantir is a corporation based in the US that is very much in the field of using AI and algorithmic innovation to help defense departments around the world, the US, but also others, in their targeting process. And I think that this large language model is the ChatGPT we're all using, but then fed with data from classified and open intelligence sources in order to help speed up and intensify battlefield decision making.
Palantir actually promotes itself as saying powering AI-assisted decision making from war zones to factory floors. So you can really see how these commercial companies, sometimes they start as startups and then develop into big companies like Palantir. Others are already very established within Silicon Valley, like Google. So you have the classic military-industrial complex, but we've referred to it in a recent publication as the military-industrial-commercial complex. The classic industrial complex produces the hardware, and the commercial is very much the software and kind of what they call the bloodline of targeting processes. So the CEO of Palantir has gone to Ukraine and announced that Palantir is involved in nearly all Ukraine's targeting processes. What's really interesting to look at the history of these companies and their roles in previous security arenas. For example, Palantir and another close, well-known startup called Clearview were companies that were first collaborating in policing operations in the US. And they said, look, we can make the streets safer, your community safer, because through the surveillance technologies that we have, we can trace and predict criminal behavior and help police arrest criminals even before they've actually engaged in a criminal act, and therefore create more security. And that they would do so with between 96 and 99% accuracy. What happened in reality was that mostly black and brown neighborhoods were surveilled, people were wrongly targeted, wrongly arrested. They were seen by their communities because they were arrested as criminals, and they therefore experience a huge amount of harm Now, thankfully, in the context of the US, there was a lot of protest. There was a lot of lawyers representing them, ultimately to get them out of prison, but also to say these systems don't work. They're not doing what they're claiming to be able to do. And
this is what's called algorithmic bias.
Exactly, the algorithmic bias. Then the police stopped working with Palantir and Clearview. What they've done is rebranded themselves and said, okay, well, actually, we'll use the same technologies in the context of war. And now they're being heralded as great successes in Ukraine and other theatres of war.
Algorithmic warfare, by design, reduces humans and human behavior to data points. That's a dehumanization. Are we comfortable with that? That our militaries are removing themselves even further from the decision-making process when they take decisions that take human lives?
And these technologies are being developed. I mean, you know, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Gaza, in the West Bank. These technologies are all being trialed. They're all being field tested in these arenas. And so, which brings to my mind this philosophical question, are these wars driving the technology or is the technology driving the wars? It seems like an absurd idea. I mean, these wars happen. Wars happen for all sorts of reasons, geostrategic, deeply flawed regional conflicts that are fed by, you know, ambition for power and economic, influence and all the rest of it. But they're all being fueled by these technologies.
Well, I think you've actually nearly directly quoted Keane, who says wars are not always about winning, but they are alternative systems of profit, power and protection. And I think this alternative systems of profit and power, when it comes to these technologies, is very key to understand that, yes, every war is a testing ground for new technologies. And we see this now in Ukraine. It's often been claimed that this is the AI-driven war. There is a lot of AI weapon systems with increasing autonomy being used and tested in Ukraine. We were just talking to another scholar involved in our program, and she was saying that in our network, somebody's been receiving lots of emails from Ukrainian soldiers saying everybody's talking about Gaza now, but we're using, you know, fully autonomous weapon systems. So absolutely, every war is a testing ground. There's nothing necessarily new about that. It's also every war is a means to get rid of old technologies. So in the Gaza situation, we see AI-driven targeting processes, but also that Israel is using really old-fashioned bombs that were used, you know, in Vietnam, and very heavy bombs. And also we had a report out just last week that CIA said about 40% of the bombs were actually not smart bombs, but dumb bombs. So in every war, we see also making space for new technologies by using old weapon systems. And also that in every war, other militaries are watching, right? So then we have this reinforcing mechanism afterwards that we see, you know, in the face of Ukraine, many NATO countries investing much more money in the military. In the Netherlands, it was 40 million, I think, in the wake of the start of the war in Ukraine. But also, for example, the Netherlands, its MQ Reapers were built and finished and their pilots trained. And in the face of the Ukraine war, they said, right now we need to arm them with bombs, whereas before they said they would only be used for surveillance technology. So every war in itself reinforces and legitimizes the further militarization.
Is the development of these technologies, AI-based, machine learning-based war-fighting technologies, is it self-propelling? The related question is about this, the technological imperative, that once you've got a set of technologies, there's no way to stop them from being developed. So is AI-based warfighting kind of inevitable? Is it the future form of warfighting? I mean, it is the form of warfighting now, largely.
Yeah, there's at least a very strong tendency towards it. Some people will say that the train has left the station and that you can't... We love this metaphor in our
hate
program.
It at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. We have a love-hate relationship with it. But the idea that indeed, like, oh, you can't halt the train anymore, it's going to come, and there's this... There seems to also be this policy perspective sort of developing that, oh, it's going to happen anyway. That means that we need to be involved in the development so that it goes in the sort of the right direction. And here's the question also of whether this development is sort of self-propelling. I would say that it seems that way, but it's usually driven, I think, by a lot of other factors, right? So geopolitical tensions, simply the development of communications, information technologies in other economic sectors, because as we've said, these technologies are very often dual use. So the military seems to mostly also be looking at what is happening externally and saying, we want to get in on that. Stay ahead. Our enemies are getting these weapons, and so must we. So a lot of this is threat perception and contestation over resources, geopolitical influence, etc. I would say that those things are ultimately more important in actually driving the integration of these technologies than the technological development itself. It's more that these things drive the development than the other way around.
I would intend to disagree.
Oh. it's not a very, very typical media scholarly thing to say, actually. If I were a real media scholar, I would say, no, it's the technology that drives itself.
I think it's the... So I think it's always humans. Humans build technologies, right?
Yes.
So there are human interests involved in innovating, developing, deploying these technologies. And maybe if we go to the nuclear example, maybe many of the listeners have been to the Oppenheimer film, we see that actually what this film beautifully illustrates, there are very many different actors involved in building these weapon systems, right? We have the military themselves. Now, these weapon systems, they facilitate the shift to remoteness, but they also are a solution to the problem that, you know, militaries have a huge deficit and human beings that want to be part of the military, right? Mm-hmm. So they are turning to these technologies to fill their ranks with other means to still be able to wage war. So that's one of the interests of the militaries involved.
That there are a lot of technology wonks out there who they could attract into the ranks.
Exactly. So they have to attract new type of people that may be willing to be part of this because they're not being deployed to theatres of war. But I think, if you talk to the military, they'll say, we need these technologies because we just don't have any new members coming in, and therefore we have, a gap, a deficiency in our ability to wage war. So these technologies are, to some extent, a solution to that problem. Then you have, the startups and the big Silicon Valley corporations. It's a huge money-making opportunity to collaborate with the militaries. There's big billion-dollar contracts on the line. They have also a interest in selling these technologies mm-hmm. as being the solution to the problem at hand, because it also it brings in major profits. We talked about the Palantir and Clearview example. They failed at a national policing level, so now they're selling themselves in the global context of war. And then there's the scientists. There's scientists that collaborate. There's the computer scientists that collaborate because that also facilitates their career. What's happened now is a lot of people have been predicting how these technologies would be used and what level of destruction we would see. Now we're seeing it play out before our eyes. This is the moment for us to say, look, we've been predicting this would be one of the outcomes of using these technologies, namely you make killing more systematic, quicker, and therefore much more destructive. Is this really what we want in warfare? What kind of societies produce these technologies? And sometimes the worst has to happen for people to wake up to understand the consequences of particular weapon systems. And we have seen, with nuclear weapon systems, other weapon systems where we've said, we as humanity or we as a society do not want to have this being used in our name. So we have to learn from those contexts and also continue to bring in these realities to contest some of the master narratives about precision and accuracy.
Lauren Gould is Assistant Professor of Conflict Studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Jessica Dorsey is Assistant Professor of International and European Law and a member of the Open Source Global Justice Investigations Lab. Dennis Janssen is a PhD candidate in the Department of Media and Culture Studies with an interest in ludification, playfulness among Dutch military innovators. For more information,